This is, I don't know how much experience each of you have had with sort of online group interviews and things like that. I've had very little myself, just a little bit with different size groups, but I still feel like I'm finding my way with them and very interested in how to make it a space, or help it to be a space for everyone where we can all kind of really be present. There's that intimacy, the body is involved, the heart is involved. So easily online with screens and virtual reality, it's easy to get a bit disembodied. So just an encouragement now, as the session goes on, to perhaps just remember from time to time to keep checking in with the body, with the mindfulness. How's the heart doing, the emotions, the intention? Just very, very, very light, but just to keep connected to that and caring for that and rooted in that, so that we can all practice just more embodied and full presence with each other. Okay, so because of the size of the group, it's probably unlikely that even if everyone did have something to ask about practice, that we would get to everyone. I mean, we might, but in the time that we have, but it's probably unlikely. So it's really fine to just listen and bring your interest and curiosity and openness and heart. But if you think you have a question, I would really encourage you to, and you feel a bit nervous about asking, it's really, really normal, really normal. But I would just encourage you to, like, nudge yourself over the edge and ask, because almost certainly your question will be helpful to someone else, maybe many other people. But very often we think, oh, my question is stupid, or it's too simple, or too basic, or too clever, or whatever it is, too advanced. All of that is just mind stuff. So again, if you can feel your heart, and just remember, it's probably going to be really, really helpful to others as well. So the encouragement, if you do want to ask or share about practice and explore that together, to really encourage you to do that. Also, I'm just aware that English is probably, or almost certainly, your second language, and I don't think I know one word in Finnish, in fact, so so I apologize for that. If there's you're trying to say something and you feel like you're struggling with English, or if I say something and if I didn't quite understand that, please, we're small enough a group to just put your hand up and say, can you just say that in other words, or ask perhaps Sari or Christian for help with your English. Not a problem at all. I'd really rather that you can participate really fully and that everyone can understand, and that the language is not a barrier, yeah? So that we all feel really together and included. Okay? Okay, so basically, as you know, the theme is about emptiness practice. It could be about questions about, or sharings, explorations about the nuts and bolts of practice, what's actually going on in practice, what you're encountering, what you're perhaps unsure about, what's unfolding, or maybe the bigger picture of understanding, they go together. So anything at all, would anyone be willing to start?
Yeah, so just either raise your hand if you found the button for that, or write something in chat, or I don't know, wave, and we'll unmute you. And oh yeah, two more things about questions. So first of all, if you don't want your question to be recorded, we can pause the recording. So just say so, and then we can pause the recording while you ask. And then yeah, as Rob said, so we're happy to help with translation in either direction. Okay, looks like we have two questions already, so let's get started.
I can't hear.
unmute myself instead. Yeah, I was trying to unmute Anna-Mari, but I muted myself. That's interesting. Anna-Mari, can you mute yourself?
No, what?
Anna-Mari had a question, but she's muted now. And I can't seem to unmute her. Oh, okay, now it seems
to work. Yeah, is it
good? Yes, now it works. Yes, I can hear you. Great.
Okay, good.
Hi, Anna-Mari. Hi.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so I've got a question about perception. Like, I've kind of noticed that if there's something like really beautiful, soulful, meaningful, a beautiful, soulful, meaningful experience, and sometimes it can be said that it's just a perception among other perceptions, and which is, you know, it is, you know, in a way it's true, but it somehow seems to take away something, or it's kind of like seems to like I don't know, like flatten things. Okay, it's just another perception, and the beauty of things is that every perception is not realer or truer than any other perception, not even the mundane ones. And yet at the same time, it feels like some perceptions, the soulful and beautiful ones, in a way require, in order to be discovered and created, require more elements coming together compared to some everyday stressful perceptions of the self and the other and the world. So I'm not actually sure what the question there is, but kind of about the perception of saying that everything's a perception, and at the same time kind of like dismiss it. Does it dismiss some of the beauty and, I don't know, the mystery of things? I don't know.
Okay, thank you. Let me see if I understand what you're asking, Anna-Mari. So we have the possibility to regard things in the sort of whole range of emptiness practices. We can regard things as just a perception. It's just a perception, just a perception. And yet there are also clearly for us in life some perceptions that are more meaningful, more important, and more soulful, as you say, than others. So it seems a bit as if it flattens out that importance that needs actually some care, you know. Is that something along those lines?
Yeah, and it, like, in order to experience something soulful, it seems that so many things have to come together in inner things, outer things, that it doesn't happen so as easily as something that seems very flat and mundane in everyday, so-called everyday life.
Yeah, yeah. So a few things here. Always remember that whatever practice we're talking about, whether it's emptiness practices or soul-making practices or mindfulness or Brahma Viharas, we're always just being pragmatic, which means what am I trying to achieve here at this moment with this practice, right? And that varies depending on what practice we're doing, okay, in the moment. So I can relate to any experience, any perception, and have quite different intentions depending on what practice I'm trying to do. Because the intention of soul making is different than the intention of just finding some peace in the moment. And it's different than the intention of maybe cultivating metta in relation to this, whatever it is. Now, these intentions may overlap, but in a way, they're different, and we need to be clear. So the intention in the moment for whatever it is that we're working with determines what tools I use. Yeah. So it might be that there's ways of regarding the emptiness of things that are kind of, they make everything equal. Everything's just like, nothing special like that. At a certain level, they make that. And that may not be that helpful for that thing and that perception in terms of soul making. So it really depends what my intention is in the moment, whether I'm viewing it that way or not. It's not like there's a right or wrong. But that's one point. The second point is maybe a little more subtle, is that when this phrase, just a perception, is to me a very interesting phrase. It's what, three words, just a perception. But it has what I call a subtext, or it has possible subtexts to it, okay? So when you are explaining it, it sounds like it's just a perception among other perceptions, is what you said, as if it's like, it's just another perception, okay? But just a perception might have a different subtext to it. What I mean by subtext is a different understanding of what's implicit in my view when I'm engaging a way of looking that's saying just a perception. So it could be, there are many perceptions, and this is just another one, is one interpretation, one subtext of just a perception. But another one is that it's fabricated. It's dependent on clinging, for instance. Okay. But even that, dependent on clinging, could have a negative connotation. It's dependent on clinging. Or a kind of more mystical connotation, the magic of the fabrication of things. So, there's, you know, we need to kind of bring a lot of subtle discernment and kind of very delicate play to these kinds of views that sound so simple, just a perception, but actually we could write paragraphs on each time we use it, what exactly is wrapped up in that way of looking, those three words that are kind of summing up the way of looking. It's not enough to sum it up. Just a perception could mean that there are many variations there. Yeah. And depending on what's in that implicit in the subtext, in the view, in the practice, in the moment, will also kind of lead to more of a magical sense of the perception, or a sacred sense, or a sense, you know, that it's kind of, it's not, you know, what's the big deal kind of thing. It will flatten out this kind of almost sacred gift sense that we get with soul making. You understand?
Yeah.
So, and yeah, we could say a lot more about this because, or maybe as a little homework, if you like, if I can give you that, maybe it's better rather than me just rattling off, is to really explore and fill out the possible. What possibly can be wrapped up in this just a perception. And you can see how even that way of looking can have a view which is very kind of dismissive, what I call wholly disinterest. You know, it's just not this, not that, not it's all, you know, on the one hand, and then a whole spectrum all the way through to the kind of the mystery of fabrication or the gift of perception. So usually when we talk about ways of looking, we think, okay, well, something in our mind is still thinking, I have the agency, this chitta, this mind has the agency to choose a way of looking, and dependent on that way of looking, this or that will arise, right? Once you start to see, well, the self is empty, and the chitta is empty, and the awareness is empty, and the intention is empty, and the way of looking is empty, and once you've gone, here I am giving you some clues, but once you've gone even beyond see the emptiness of the unfabricated, then everything opens up, and you could see just a perception is also, it can contain with it something of a divine gift, and that would be more of a soul-making view, etc. You know, but that's not taken as a reality. That's a view that's entertained. You understand?
Yeah.
So, I think better for you to take your question and just unpack all the possibilities—not all, but some of the possibilities—that just a perception could mean, and really play with them. You know, not just in the mind, but really play with them. And feel in the heart and in the soul, as well as in what it does to perception, the effects, you know. One more thing, you know, so some of the emptiness views, we have some feedback somewhere. Is that Tommy? Is that okay? So one with these emptiness views, you know, as some of you will know, as I look at something, as I engage a way of looking with this thing, this perception, whatever it is, with some emptiness view, it begins to fade a little bit. or a lot or whatever. And then we can actually play with how much it fades. You understand? So how much I lean on that emptiness view in the way of looking in practice at any moment will determine how much this perception fades. As it fades more and more, there's a kind of mystical beauty in the fading. You know, that's another perception, but it's a mystical beauty. But I can also kind of lean on it somewhat, but not too much. So it's kind of, it's less substantial, and it seems kind of transparent and radiant and diaphanous and empty but appearing. It's, I'm keeping it in the middle range by not leaning too much. Does this make sense?
Yeah.
And in that middle range, it's still appearing, but now it's got this, rather than this, it's just a perception, it's actually got this almost divine quality to it, and it becomes a lot more malleable. So, So there is both what's included in the just a perception that we said before, that's one point. The second point is how much I'm leaning at any time towards the fading. Now, the fading itself can reveal, as I said, a kind of mystical beauty, which is itself a perception, or not so intense, and I just kind of let it hover in this kind of mid space of between, let's call emptiness and form, or the empty appearances or whatever, and that too can have this real sacred beauty and have with it all the elements of the imaginal and the soul making that you know about. So lots of homework to play with.
Thank you.
Yeah? Okay, good. Okay. Yeah, lovely. Anyone else?
I think Ape's Karp has a question. Let's see if I can unmute him. You're on, Ape. Can you?
Yes.
Great. Can you hear me? Yes, I can hear you at least.
Okay. Hello, Rob.
Hi, Ape. We've never met. Hi there.
Hey, hello. I live in northern Finland in Oulu. Nice to meet you.
You too.
Yeah, so I've been doing some forms of emptiness practice for a couple of years, but I found your book just a few months ago. And during, let's say, last 6 months, there has been quite intense and a lot of this kind of perception where spontaneously during the day in different activities, the perception switches a little bit so that there's more clarity, more vividness of colors and intensity in the way of looking, and there's joy and many kind of wonderful feelings and associations with it. And during these months, it has been happening more often and more intensely. But let's say in couple of weeks now, it has been a little bit too much. You know, it has this, this is a little bit too much. I wouldn't like to have so much of this because it makes me feel a little bit being too much in the sun or something like this. So I was reading your book and there was something about this, that perhaps this insight and samadhi, they should be in a kind of balance. So this could be one thing here, to have more samadhi quality there perhaps, but I'm not sure. So I was thinking about what you have to say about this, some insights on this. Now I can't hear you.
No. Okay.
Okay.
No. Thank you. Thank you, Ape. So can I ask particularly what practices you've been doing in the last few months as this has gotten more intense, really, as the intensity of experience has built up?
Well, for the last couple of years, I've been doing more or less this kind of a looking at the one who looks. I'm not sure what you call this practice. It started to happen more spontaneously, but this is how I have been kind of calling it, awareness of awareness, perhaps.
Okay, good. Lovely, and really, really lovely practice. I think a couple of things. That's actually quite an intense practice, just focusing on awareness itself. And in some Tibetan traditions, they say that because of, you don't have to get worried about this, but they actually say it can cause in Tibetan medicine what they call a wind condition, etc. So it's there's something about it that does something that affects the energy, so it's quite intense. I wouldn't necessarily worry too much about that. I think maybe at this point, more in line with what you were thinking, that it might be good to balance your insight practice with either some samadhi or some metta practices, you know, and really to do those in a way. You said you had the book, so in a way that's as described in my book, that really involves the whole body and the energy of the body. And so again, when we talk about samadhi, there's ways of doing it that can build intensity in ways that sometimes are not that helpful. Okay. They can be great and really useful, but sometimes, and depending on what else is going on, they're not that helpful. They're a bit too intense, or they're a bit tip the system in a way that, yeah, as I said, is not that helpful. So for example, intensely focusing on a small point, really concentrating on a small point, probably at this point, not that helpful.
Yeah.
There's ways of practicing samadhi there in my book, in chapter 5, for instance, if you want, or you can find recordings online or speak to Sari or Yuhar, for instance, that involve the whole body and the energy. And these start to open up and get softer and nicer and warmer. And one just kind of melts into that or dwells in that. And because of what it really does is it integrates body and consciousness in a soft, warm, lovely space. And that would be a really good balance to what you're doing.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Oh, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was actually having a cycling today, and I was having this kind of experience there, and I then moved it more towards the heart and the whole body, and after 15 minutes or something, that kind of feeling a little bit sick vanished, and I was feeling great. And actually the intensity of this clarity was stronger, but not with this negative associations.
Yeah, so there you are, and you can really develop that. And I think it would be a really good idea. I think it would be a really, really good idea. So even what you did today when you were cycling, that's great. And if you want, you could develop it further. And I think that would be very good. There's another thing as well. So, you know, everyone teaches emptiness in different ways, and it means different things to different teachers. And you'll come across that. But in the way I would understand emptiness, this kind of what you're calling clarity and vividness and intensity of experience, the colors getting, everything getting sharper, it's really just an initial stage of practice. And in a way, we want to also go beyond that, okay? Where it seems like the opposite is happening. Instead of things getting more vivid, they actually begin to fade, okay? Everything begins to blur and fade and get softer, if you like. And it's not that we want to live in a state of blurred, faded softness, but there's something about that movement from normal experience to this kind of clarity, and then the whole spectrum of fading. There's something about that that's of fundamental significance in the whole exploration of emptiness. So in a way, that's just understanding where this experience that you're describing sits on in the journey into exploring emptiness, where it's placed in the trajectory of what we're trying to do. Yeah, it might also be that there's other ways of other emptiness practices that would be really helpful in addition to what you're doing. So we talked about the samadhi or the metta, but also it might be good to do some, I mean, the one I'm thinking of right now has, if you have my book, it's called the second dukkha method. And really what it's about, you can look it up later, but, and I think there's some, guided meditations or instructions online somewhere, but really what it's about is relaxing the relationship with experience as it comes up. That's my, when I'm doing that practice, that's the job that I'm doing. I'm noticing whenever there's a kind of pushing away or pulling, even subtle, I'm just relaxing that again and again and again. So you can hear, even when I describe the practice, it just, it's a soft practice. It's a softening practice. That doesn't mean it's not profound and powerful. It's incredibly profound and powerful. But the whole flavor of it is very, is much softer and more melting and relaxing, etc. And sometimes what that does is it allows more depth to happen without this kind of turbulence. Yeah.
Yeah.
So another kind of emptiness practice would be watching very rapid impermanence, you know, really microscopic impermanence. Fantastic practice, but that one too can bring quite a lot of energetic turbulence and intensity and kind of rock the boat for some people. So it might be good, like I said, in addition to what you're doing, not just the samadhi or the metta, but also to have one or two other emptiness practices which have a very different way of unfolding, a very different flavor and tenor to them, that equally powerful but just unfold in different ways that will allow the whole thing to deepen much more stably and much more easefully. Yeah. Does that sound okay?
Yes, yeah. Very good.
Okay, thank you, Ape. Yeah.
Great, thanks. Are there any more questions? I don't see any raised hands right now or anything in the chat. I actually have a question as well. Oh, there's one from Mikhail. Maybe I'll let Mikhail go first. Okay, you should be unmuted now, Mikhail.
Okay. Can you hear me, Rob?
I can hear you very well. Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you. I'm very happy to see you.
Me too.
And what you said in the beginning of helpful questions that, or questions being helpful to others too, it's just funny to see how Anna Mari's question and the Abe's question is somehow related to what I wanted to ask. This question is more to do with, has more to do with emptiness in the bigger picture of my life or anyone's life. And I would like to ask about your description of the spectrum of emptiness, or emptiness being a spectrum with complete cessation of perception in one end and then full-on fabrication in one end. And the question is basically that how to bring more stability or more range to the moving through of that spectrum, or moving somewhere else than the extremes. And I'm asking this because in my life and in my practice, I have this tendency to move towards the extremes somehow. I'm either interested in practicing full-on emptiness practices, going like full-on deeply into the emptiness side of things and loving the cessation and all the freedom that it brings. Or then I'm full-on fabrication, full-on creativity and art, in my case, music and writing. And that seems completely different world than the emptiness side of things. And there does not seem to be a middle ground or middle range, as you just said in the previous answer. And in a way, yes, I could live like this, bipolary, but it's a little bit straining and to move like bam, this end, and bam, this end, and bam, back and forth. And also, although it seems like there's a wide range I actually have started to feel like it's quite narrow in a way. It's basically I'm craving for more colors, not just black and white. So how to bring more stability or more colors to the range between cessation and full-on fabrication?
So is it a double question in the sense that you're asking both about your everyday life and work as well as formal meditation practice? Or are you talking just in meditation practice? Or?
Well, in this case, I might be asking a double question. I'm interested in both, yes.
Okay. So, and when you say cessation, what are you doing that opens up an experience of cessation? What practices are you doing?
Well, lately I've been practicing samadhi and the jhanas, and especially in the context of emptiness, treating or seeing the jhanas as ways of experiencing different levels of cessation. And then also experimenting with seeing the emptiness of awareness. Yeah.
Okay, so when you say cessation, you really mean a spectrum. You don't mean a, because I usually use that word as just an endpoint, but you really mean a more fading, like towards more fading.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so this is really important, Mikhail. So I wonder, similar to Anna Marie's question, if there's a possibility of, let's backtrack. Before I even answer, because this often influences what people choose to do. So already there's a desire in your question, expressed in your question, for a desire for more middle ground. As you say, it's actually quite narrow, because really I have one point here and one point here, as opposed to the whole range between them. So your desire is there for that middle ground. If you ask me, and again, it's in the book towards the end, it's like, where's all this going, all this emptiness business? So again, depends who you ask and what their interpretation of it is, but all this business about fabrication and fading and the fading of perception, that whole spectrum, it's not for the purpose of living down at that end, okay? Mm. It's something we understand in that, getting to that point or getting somewhere towards that point. We understand something about this world and this self. So one thing is prioritizing understanding over experience, okay? Now, some people really do like the deep end of fading. It's very lovely, but, and you can enjoy it, but part of you always wants to prioritize understanding. What does that mean then about the world? And this understanding is, this is what we call the middle way. Emptiness is not saying, nah, nothing matters. I might as well not write. I might as well not do music. I might as well. Then I've gone towards nihilism, right? So the understanding maturing is both kind of keeping on that middle way, or wobbling about it quite closely. Yeah. So that actually your passion and your love and beauty and commitment and values can all still be there. If they go, something's tipped over too far. Okay. You understand? In that moment, it needs a little rectifying. So that's one piece, but also the understanding is really to do with the fabricated nature of what we call reality, perception. We don't stop there, though, in the way that I would present it, okay? You might get to the unfabricated and deep ceasing, but then you even see that that's empty, and that starts to change your whole kind of relative valuing of cessation or fading over not. Everything opens out in a different way. In some Mahayana teachings and Vajrayana teachings, they say that a Buddha is one who is able to deeply know the emptiness of things and still perceive forms. They don't fade necessarily. We can imitate that. That's what tantric practice does, is an imitation of a Buddha's state of mind. Okay, it's like a fake Buddha. So if we say, where are we going with all this emptiness business anyway? It's not that we're just going to the unfabricated. It's that we're going towards an understanding which liberates, and then this freedom to play in this kind of pretend Buddha land, if you like, that's, as I said to Anne-Marie, hovering in this space that's, things are empty, they're more transparent, they're less substantial, they're magical and divine as well. And that means actually you have to have some control over how deep you go, by, in a way, how intensely you're holding a certain emptiness view at any time, like we said with Anne-Marie. One way of helping this is to, and again, it's somewhere in the book, it's in the chapter, I have it here, it's in the chapter, chapter about emptiness and love, emptiness views and the sustenance of love, chapter 24, if you want. Because what that's doing is it's taking other beings, or this being, or the experience that we have, and, for example, giving metta towards this being, or compassion, or offering up this dukkha that I have, or this happiness that I have, giving it for the sake of other people. And I might see it's empty to a certain extent, but I can't dissolve it too much, because I have to retain some sense of another person, and some sense of these things that I'm offering up to them with this kind of bodhisattva intention. Yeah, if they fade too much, I've lost the beauty of that particular practice. Everything fades. It's great, but it's all the same. So there's this kind of very exquisite middle range. But what might help explore it is if part of your intention is really to be doing practices like metta or compassion or exchanging self and other, with emptiness in the mix of those practices, so that you're kind of hovering in that mid range. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And then in regard to your, so that would be, you know, the more you do that, then the more you're really opening up that some of that middle territory, you know. And then, I mean, there are other ways too, but let's just say that for now. In terms of your life, you know, and your work, writing and music, and here, perhaps my first inclination is not necessarily to try and pull the emptiness in there. Okay. Mm-hmm. I would rather pull the soul making in there. Okay, so here is work and a project to be done, or creative projects to be done, and the self that's doing those projects. Now, we could say, well, that self is empty and you just see it that way and the project is empty. And sure, you could do all that, but it might be, I know this is an emptiness interview, but I just think it might be more fruitful to let those creative processes and projects become more imaginal. Let them be more imaginally infused. Now, that's going to include the project itself, who your audience is, or your, you know, whatever, and the self that's engaged in them. Yeah. And in being imaginal, then they will start to occupy the imaginal middle way, which is also neither real nor not real. It's not a complete fading at all. But there's a way they fill out a space that's in kind of empty, but in a different kind of way. And it can still have all that beauty and dedication and hard work and soulfulness and joy in it, yeah? And that might be a way, because in some ways they're close enough, this imaginary little way and the emptiness, but they're close enough to kind of, what would we say, sort of, stretch the bubble gum between these two points that you have, you know, so it's across the range there. Does that sound okay?
Yes, that sounds really helpful in many ways. Yeah, thank you.
You want to say something more, or is that okay? You don't have to.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on things that came up to my mind as you were speaking, because I just noticed that part of the problem is that actually, well, some part of me has a distaste for anything neutral, anything that this might be a personality trait also. I know that I have a personality that is tending towards the extremes in many parts of life. So I appreciate you saying or bringing up that the creative process is might not be benefiting of the emptiness ways of looking, at least right now, because this that kind of perception has, to me, before seemed like something like Anna-Mari was describing with the flattening and somehow making it more boring, making it more middle, making it more neutral. Whereas actually my personality would like it to be extreme. Yeah. And well, that has its problems, but
sure. And there's always this question of like, you know, what is actually needed by a certain soul?
Mm.
And what is just a kind of pathology? And actually, you need to see a psychiatrist.
Yes, I'm seeing already.
There is that. I would encourage you to let it be soulful. But yeah. Remember, like I said, part of soulfulness is an imaginal middle way.
Yes.
When it gets too rarefied, when the self-doing gets too rarefied in the project, it starts to actually contract and not feel so fertile, not feel so soulful and beautiful. So let these... you know when you're in that territory and you get more discriminating about now I'm out of the territory. And it might be because I've rarefied it and made too much pressure for this self to be fantastic and intense and whatever it is. And I've believed it all too much. Yeah. In some way that's actually squeezing the joy and the juice and the soul out of it. Yeah. Now, because you said, that's one thing, because you said what you said and shared about what you I think also, you know, it might be really good just to go back at sometimes. It doesn't have to be all the time, just a little bit here and there in the big picture of your practice at the moment, and just spend some time doing some basic mindfulness practice with like neutral Vedana, you know. Listen, neutral and subtle are very close together. Okay, so you say, most people are not interested in neutral. You get the same thing with the Brahmavihara practice. It's where people, sometimes the neutral is more difficult than the difficult because people, it's just not interesting. So we need as practitioners to be able just to hang out with the neutral. When I hang out with the neutral and I'm not interested, it becomes boring and actually slightly unpleasant. When I hang out with the neutral and I bring a kind of subtlety of attention, a subtlety of sensitivity to it, actually the neutral starts to become colored and in its own way, beautiful. Everything that arises is dependent. It might not ever get super intense, or it might actually, dependent on your way of looking at it. But there's something to explore in that neutral range. So I'm not saying change your life, Mikhail. Go see a psych. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just saying there's a middle range there, just in practice, even if it's 10 minutes here and there. You know what? I'm going to sit down and just feel the sensations in my bum right now or in my big toe. And yeah, unless you're either in pain or a jhana, it's like they're not going to be either here nor there. But there's something about just being willing to hang out there and what can I learn? What can I tolerate? And developing the capacity to include that range in my attention, but also in the sensitivity there to learn about dependent arising. What is this neutral? And you know, once we start getting into some of those practices, like exchanging self and other with neutral sensations, what was neutral starts to be, you know, mystically colored and beautiful and profound sense of participation in it, etc. So just because it's neutral doesn't mean that it's kind of doomed to be not interesting. Yeah. So the how the neutral appears depends on how you relate to it. Yeah. So what I'm really suggesting is within the context of your practice or everything you've described, just 10 minutes here and there, just being willing to show up for the neutral and bring some sensitivity and some attention to that. in different sense spheres, etc. So it doesn't have to take over your practice, but you just throw that in a little bit as well.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I will do that. Thank you. Yeah.
And then write to me and tell me how that bit's going at some point.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, I think I'll ask my question at this point. I don't know if it's Eros or craving, but I'll go with it anyway. yeah, it was actually kind of this, what you said. You could say that in some sense, my question is related to what you just said about, like, you know, is it a pathology or is it soulful? And it's kind of like this eternal question that is this. Well, anyway, I need to give a little bit of context. I've been reading your book since it came out and sort of digesting that material in some form. In some ways, these emptiness practices and the entire framework, it feels very natural for me. Like my mind naturally somehow thinks in terms of multiple viewpoints and sort of the relations between them. So it's I'm known for being like, if I open my mouth, usually I end up talking quite a lot, and it's because it's hard for me to find a sentence that doesn't immediately, you know, there's these disclaimers and okay, so it's hard to find anything that's actually true, because it's always contextual. And as you can imagine, like, you know, doing emptiness practices doesn't necessarily make this easier. right. And then there's this sort of drive, you know, I've been analyzing myself for years from various points of view. And one of these fundamental drives that doesn't seem to be reducible to anything else is this drive to sort of understand everything or understand things deeply. And it usually, for me, means kind of finding out how things are connected and like what they are most fundamentally, if anything. And from this, you know, emptiness is sort of the ultimate drug here. Or, I mean, you know, because it's kind of like the ultimate connection between these, between different things. So that's been very appealing in that sense. And I've also, as long as I've been studying the Dharma, I've been trying to, you know, study it from different angles, because I kind of want to, you know, find a, if there are two teachers who both seem to make sense to me, then I want to find a conceptual framework that can somehow accommodate both of them. Like, I need to somehow contextualize them. Even if it, you know, turned out to be that, yeah, these can't be reconciled, but then I can still reconcile them that, okay, these are the two fundamental things, you know, these are the poles or whatever. So this might sound really abstract, but actually it's very concrete and fundamental for me. But so the issue, like in practical, actual practice, it's always been difficult for me to actually do techniques or even like observe one object. I remember that used to be a long time ago confusing for me. You know, what does it even mean to observe one object to the exclusion of something else? Because, you know, things are always connected. And I've noticed it's also kind of hard for me. I'm not even sure how to map that to my experience, like how to, you know, choose one point of view. So that's kind of, you know, I've been reading, I just finished reading your book for the third time, and it really resonates with me. And I can find, you know, in the different practices or techniques that are listed, some of them feel familiar that, yeah, I've kind of done something like that. But at the same time, like the way I think this is part of just, I don't know if this is my personality or pathology or both, but I have this kind of fantasy. I want to see things in a sense, you know, connected to each other. So I want to see my practice, in a sense, I'm always doing the same thing, because I want to view practice so generally that it somehow includes, you know, everything that to my best understanding seems that it should be included, if that makes sense.
Not quite the last bit. Can you try that again?
Yeah. So what I mean is that, So I've kind of been like mainly in practice, I've been practicing in the Utejaniya style that you're maybe familiar with. But what I feel like, it's not like I'm actually, you know, doing like bare mindfulness or just being with things as they are. It's more like something is happening, experience, there's something being experienced, and then I just sort of unleash my mind on it. So it will naturally consider it from different points of view and sort of reflect on everything, you know, that it's sort of digested. Of course, like, you know, that process is conditioned. So what's prominent right now probably depends on what I read yesterday and things like this. That's what I mean by it's very hard for me to sort of approach practice like, okay, now I'm going to do this technique. I I've never been able to do a guided meditation, for example. Like I've been practicing for quite a while, and there's just something I can understand it conceptually, and I can sort of imagine that it works like this for some people, but it feels kind of alien to me. Like I can understand intellectually, like originally I was very much of a myth of no myth guy. And I can critique that intellectually, that, you know, there's no such thing as doing nothing or just being with experience, because there's always, you know, some point of view that conditions what's happening. I don't know. It's still, does this sort of explain?
I think I understand the, I get a picture of where you're at. I just wonder, is there a question with this or?
Right. So I guess the question, like I said originally about, you know, what's a personality trait and what's a pathology? I've been trying to, like, for example, I can analyze, I can understand how what Utejaniya teaches, how it fits into the framework that you lay out in Seeing That Freeze. I've also listened to some of the imaginal talks. So for example, there's the dukkha practice, because we're working with clinging all the time in different situations. There's a certain amount of anatta. There's this kind of cultivating the view of seeing things as nature. He doesn't like the word anatta, but that's basically what he's pointing at, as far as I can tell. There's a kind of a measure of holy disinterest and so on. So I feel like, I guess the question is kind of like, is this a problem? Because I don't want to sort of, you know, limit myself. But at the same time, I want to kind of respect and you know, I've had similar problems in other areas in life. For example, I've been singing for 20 years and like that's been a kind of journey finding how I should approach this. And I can see that it works in practice. I can see that my practice works in practice, at least in some sense. I mean, I'm not entirely sure if there's a problem here or not and how I should sort of approach that.
Yeah. Thank you, Christian. I don't know. And occasionally I get asked something exactly like this. And I think my honest answer is my honest answer is really a question, is just if it feels like it's progressing, you know, then you can trust it. If it feels like there's certain openings or experiences or understandings that I kind of get, I understand the description or whatever, but I've no idea how I would get there, then I would still have that question. How is that going to happen? You know, it's not to say you should or shouldn't do. It's just to say, as I said, I don't know how certain openings will happen. I don't know how, for example, a complete fading of perception would happen without some kind of sustained and kind of comprehensive and deep letting go, you know. Right. So but you know, it doesn't mean it won't. It just it seems, and maybe it's my personality is different, but I can't really see how that happens. Sometimes things do, all kinds of things happen. So it's really not as linear as it seems, or as sort of formulaic as it seems. Sometimes intuition operates, things are kind of coming together in almost in the unconscious, and then there's a sudden realization of something, you know. So it's definitely possible. I think if I'm honest, I don't see it be that deeply successful without some kind of more careful application of exactly what one's doing in meditation. But that doesn't mean it can't be. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to. At some point, I was thinking that maybe it's actually just a point of view, because if I look at, like, in some sense, I feel like I'm always doing the same thing. But if I actually look at the details, then that's not entirely true. Like, I'm not doing exactly the same. Or rather, if I can frame it, like, in a very abstract way, that my practice is sort of, you know, figuring out there's some sort of mindfulness, some sort of awareness of what's going on. And then there's some kind of response to that.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of a question of, you know, point of view, am I doing something? Or is, like, you know, the mind just sort of naturally responds?
Sure.
It's just, I guess, yeah, feels like you can, you know, you can look at it either way. That if there's, suddenly the mind realizes that, oh, okay, this is going to lead to suffering, so I'm going to stop doing that. Did I actually do something, or did it happen by itself? Well, you know, that's kind of a question of point of view.
Yeah, but there's a slight difference between I'm confronted with this problem, whatever it is, this dukkha, and then either deliberately, consciously, or as you say, just the mind doing it, that dukkha getting, you know, dissolved or whatever. That's great. That's an important part of practice. It's a whole other thing then to kind of follow a track deeper and deeper into emptiness and the nature of reality. You know, they're actually, they're connected intentions, but they're actually a little bit different.
Right.
And I think it's really the second one that it can happen, you know, in just this, absolutely it can. And, you know, I want to be careful about what's my personality style, not imposing that on anyone. So I had an interview with someone the other day. It's like, I'm not going to tell you to practice how, you know, and you should practice, this is the only way to liberation. I'm not going to say that. I don't even think that, you know, but I actually can't understand quite or how it might happen the other way. And in terms of just probabilities, it seems less likely. I mean, you might get lucky and things, you know, I don't know, but it's hard. Now, so there's two things.
Mm.
I'll throw something else into the mix, which is a slightly maybe contentious thing to say, provocative thing to say, which is what also matters here is your sense of, let's call it the soulfulness of your practice. But what I really mean is, how exciting is it all to you? How much are you like really interested in all this stuff? How much is it a thing of beauty that you're engaging these questions, that you have this practice, even if it's not, you know, mapped out like someone like me or someone like Elswood? You know, there's a certain liberation and beauty and opening that comes just from feeling we're on the on our track.
Yeah.
You know? And it's a weird thing to say because it rarely gets talked about in practice. So we just talk about, no, liberation is this thing where you see this and that this happens, and, you know, as if this kind of, yeah, let's call it the soul sense of our practice has nothing to do with it. And actually, that's not really true. You know, you may have heard me say, we need to have a fantasy of ourselves as practitioners, and a fantasy of the path, and a fantasy of tradition, and a fantasy even of reacting to some things in the, all of that makes up both the sense of beauty in what we're doing and soulfulness, and also the liberation, because they go together. So there's a whole other level of this, as I said, that rarely gets talked about, that, you know, you might want to check in with that. And actually that may be more important than someone like me saying, oh no, you really need to use these approach, and someone else saying, no, you do, you know, it's like, so I wouldn't underestimate the power of the intuition, but I don't know in terms of probability, but there's this whole other kind of dimension as well that's, I think, really, really important. You know, we're as liberated by feeling like we're on an exciting journey of exploration, and we stand somewhere in a history of tradition connected, and, you know, to the past and to teachers that are mythical figures, and we're at our edge exploring and things are opening up and we're wrestling with things. All that's actually really beautiful and liberating. And, you know, people say, oh, isn't that just self? It's like, you know, it's a lot more, I think, interesting than just kind of ignoring it or dismissing it. So there's that whole other dimension. That would be, again, a question back to you. It's like, well, is that there? How much is it there? And if it's not there, then that would be another reason to really kind of consider what you're doing and try a few different things until that sense comes. And it can't be there all the time. Mm. In a lifetime of practice, you're always going to get some periods of doldrums, some periods of like, I'm just a bit stagnant here, I'm less inspired. But generally speaking, that's a really, you know, key element and key kind of engine for you know, furnace for our practice. So there's that aspect to consider as well.
I guess you mean Eros. I mean, it's not our topic here, but
I mean Eros, but in the larger sense of really that it's really the whole thing has become. It does, you know, if I say imagine, some people who might have listened to that might say, what are you actually talking about? But yeah, I mean that. But the whole thing, including yourself and the path and all these texts and the history and all that becomes like, it's exciting and I'm grappling with it and I'm on my journey and I'm on my edge and I feel myself expanding into new territory, you know, and that's exciting. And also there's some dukkha in it. There's like, I want it and I don't know how to do this piece and I'm just at an edge here and I'm confused. You know, even the dukkha as part actually can be very beautiful and ensouling and in a strange way liberating, you know.
Yeah.
So that's my view at least. Whether we call it, you know, whatever language we put on it. But yeah, basically the imaginal and the eros in relation to you and your path and your practice and the tradition and all that, you know. And that's a really important piece, I think. Really, it vitalizes, it gives life to things, yeah. And in that life is a certain amount of liberation. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay. I don't know, I was going to say, I wish I could give you just a straight answer, but...
I know, but I didn't give you a straight question either. You know, I tried to fit in, like, you know, because I've been thinking... probably as long as I've been reading your book, at least, like, you know, what would I ask Rob if I ever had the chance? So there was like, you know, 3 years worth of thinking that I tried to come into a few minutes. And, you know, usually I run into trouble when I try to ask, you know, just a normal, simple question. So, yeah. No, but this was actually helpful. And
yeah, good. I was going to say, I wish I could give you a straight and simple answer, but actually looking inside, I'm not sure that I wish that I could. maybe it's better to have it more, kind of give it back to you and let it be open, you know, rather than insisting on something too simplistic like that.
Definitely. Yeah. So, thanks.
Yeah.
What about just time? I think we have time for at least one more question, but how do you want to finish at half past, as was the original schedule, or...
I think we should, just to respect, you know, that's the time that people
reserved.
You know, reserved, and they may have other things to do. So we'll maybe take, let's see how we do, but let's go till half past. Yeah.
Okay. So I don't see any hands raised or anyone in the chat. Would someone like to ask or share something? I'm warning you, I'll talk more if no one else asks anything. Anyone? Oh, Sini Maria. Okay, great. I'm unmuting you. Okay, great.
Oh, I've got problems with my connection, so
I can hear you.
I don't know if it,
I can hear you.
You can, okay.
Oh, maybe it's stalling a little bit. Sini Maria, why don't you turn off your video, and it might have any.
Okay.
We can hear the question, but it might be taking up some of the bandwidth. I don't know.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah.
I guess if worst comes to worst, you can write the question and then Rob can respond.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it's about the sense of self, that my question. Somehow it's easy for me or easier to kind of feel the emptiness of the self when it's relating to something. But then how do I say it? when I go in somehow into my body and sense my body, it kind of feels that there is some intensity or some kind of how do you call it? Intensity or not contraction, but I don't know the word in English, but like tiivistymä. What would that be in English? Does anyone know?
Tiivistymä. Do you mean like, siis että se on jotenkin tiheempi? Tai...
Yeah.
So it's somehow like something that's kind of like denser, like there's something more solid.
Yeah, like a density. Yeah, the sense of density, and when I'm with that, really real.
Can you say that last bit again, Sini Maria? It just cut out slightly.
Okay, yeah. So when I go into my body and kind of sense the body, it feels that there's density. Usually it's around the chest area, and it kind of feels really real, and it kind of feels that, oh, that's me, even that I kind of know that there is no little me inside there. But then if I have... something that's outside, or if I have some thought or something else, it's kind of easier to maybe see that that's not me or not mine. But it's somehow with the body and the sense of the body that feels very kind of real and yeah. Mm. I don't know if you want to say something about that. I don't know if I have a question, but it's
okay. Yeah. So this is, it's, if I understand you, it's quite common actually for exactly that, a certain kind of density or contraction in the body to feel like somehow that's where the self is, even if we don't really think, oh, there's a little doll there or something. But it's quite common, and it's also quite common for people who are practicing to kind of slowly over time start to feel like that place is a problem. And the way that the self is constellated there feels like a problem. And it's almost like we begin to get a very slow waging war on this experience there. So what you're describing is, you know, relatively common. I think it needs a lot of care, you know. I wonder. I wonder a few things. It's like it might be important to not approach it so directly. Okay, So, for example, as you say, in, again, I go back to that practice that I call the second dukkha practice, and or any other practice, maybe impermanence or some lens like that, some way of looking like that, but don't necessarily focus on this place first of all. Focus on other things, you know, and let this place eventually be included. But if you like, you use the momentum of seeing the impermanence of other sensations in the body, or thoughts, or whatever it is. You let that build more. A couple of things will happen then. Once that has built, or you've, for instance, let go of the push and pull, the clinging, the pushing away, the grasping and aversion in relation to lots of phenomena, but not necessarily going there to this place first, then it will be easier to take that kind of pervasion of that other way of looking begins naturally, like water, to just lap over that area that feels a little bit like it's not being affected in time. But if I go straight head on for it, I'm a little bit, even if I'm doing my best not to, I've already set this place up as a bit of an enemy, as a bit of something I'm trying to get rid of and obliterate. And that very stance in relationship to it, that very conception in relationship to it, which can be very subtle, is already a kind of aversion. And I'm approaching it trying to get rid of it, which is a kind of aversion which will only sustain it, because it's a kind of clinging that will fabricate it more. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But the funny thing that when you started to talk about making it as an enemy, I feel the opposite, that it feels so precious somehow.
Okay.
That I don't even, there is this kind of maybe like, do I even want to find it empty? Like, yeah. Do I even want to kind of,
yeah,
it to fade away, yeah, somehow?
Okay. So, but again, so that's really interesting. And again, this too is important. Remember, it's hard with, because we tend to, I don't want to see something's empty, because I feel like if I do see it, this goes back to Anne-Marie's question at the beginning, it's related. If I do see it as empty, then I won't recognize its preciousness. Mm. So the very understandable, but it's actually, in the end, it turns out to be a not a complete enough understanding of what it means for something to be empty.
Mm.
So really, when something can be empty and it can be, you know, gorgeously precious and beautiful and sacred, and we can be in that, and even when we really understand, I can even identify with it, so no problem. So sometimes I might have just intellectually to understand that that's actually where we're headed, and this fear that you have or reluctance there is very normal, but it's based on a slight misunderstanding of, yeah, what this means, a bit too much on the nihilism side. Very normal. But again, I wonder if the answer is still a little bit the same. It's like not to actually just not to put too much focus on this while you're wanting to in the period that you're exploring an emptiness practice. Don't worry too much about this. Don't say, oh, I'm going to have to see that thing as empty. Just get on with ways of looking in terms of other phenomena, other places in the body, other perceptions, etc., and the relationship with them. At some point, as you do that, kind of almost out of the corner of your eye, so to speak, you will begin to realize that this place of density starts to feel different, and not in a problematic way. Or, I mean, it might be sometimes that a little fear arises, but the general trajectory is you start to, oh, it's different now. And then all kinds of questions. Well, which one is the real sensation that corresponds to the real me, the denser one or the less dense one? But you're not actually, I wouldn't make a project of trying to see this as empty, or trying to get rid of it, or even trying to retain it. I would perhaps just kind of, as I said, get on with doing the emptiness practices in kind of soft ways, like the second dukkha practice. But it could also be like anicca, impermanence, or anatta, whatever works for you. And as you do that more pervasively, the whole experience of everything, but including the self and including the body and the density of the body, will just very gradually begin to change. And you'll start to get more and more aware of what those changes are, notice them as they're happening, and more comfortable with them. So that this tends to be, okay, this thing can be looked at as self and felt as self and also seen to be not self, both. There's a freedom there. But still making it a target in any way sometimes tends to backfire with emptiness practices. So it might be much more helpful, to just let the whatever ways of looking you're using, let them just get occupied and pervaded, get occupied with other phenomena and let that pervade more. And then that will do the work it needs to do here, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else about that, or that's okay?
No, thanks. I think that's very helpful view.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. And don't judge or let anyone kind of criticize you for saying, oh, if you're identifying with this place in your chest and you think it's important and special, that's not Buddhism or that's not the right. Just don't worry about that. Keep with what feels beautiful and important and meaningful and even sacred to you, and just do the emptiness practices as well, but not so much target on that. And everything that needs to happen will happen, but in a much softer way, rather than more kind of combative or resistant or whatever.
Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. You're very welcome. So my clock says it's time to end. Is that correct? Yeah.
My clock agrees.
Okay. Can we have just a few moments of silence together? Is that okay?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, thank you so much, everyone. It's really lovely to spend time with you in this way and to meet those of you that I've never met before, at least a little bit. And there's some faces I recognize, but I don't think I've ever spoken to, and also some people I know. So really, really lovely for me. And thank you for sharing the time and being present and open in this way.
Thanks. Let's see. I'm trying to unmute, sorry, but I can't.
I think now it works. So thank you, Rob, very much. This was really rich and lovely and beautiful offering. And it was really lovely to, hang out with you and explore the themes. And also I want to thank everyone who was joining and having the courage of asking the questions, because it's not always easy to be seen and heard this way in a Zoom. So it was really lovely to have this opportunity. And I would like to just, as it's been really beautiful offering from Rob's side, I would like to revisit something I was writing about earlier in the email, when I was inviting all of you to the Zoom, that just reminding of something that all of us are actually very familiar with, that the kind of culture of generosity and dana, and how Rob's been offering us his time and, the wisdom and love of Dharma and all this beautiful that we've been listening to for 1.5 hours now. And just if you feel inclined to offer something back there is this link in the email I sent you. There was this donate button for Dharma Seed page where you could and you can, and hopefully this, as it's really important to have this chance to offer back, you can use that to offer something to Rob for this beautiful teaching. Does anyone have a question about the Dana, how it works? I think all of us are really familiar with that. So did everyone get the link? And I think if all of you got two emails, it should be there. And is there anything you'd like to add, Rob? Say anything about the Dana? Or
no, thank you. Just thank you very much. And yeah, thank you to Christiane and to Sari for organizing. I think Juha was involved, but he wasn't able to join us. And thank you all for being here. Yeah, and much, really appreciate
thank you.
What you brought. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Okay. Bye-bye, everyone. Blessings for your practice.